This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening and welcome to The Informer. Dean Beck with you this evening. Tonight we'll take a look at just why the CEO of Scarlet Alliance, the sex worker advocate organisation, was at the Sexual Health Conference, and we'll find out what Anna Brown had to say when she met Jim Obergefell, the man who brought the US Supreme Court case that put marriage equality across the line in the USA. Last week, I went along to the Australasian Sexual Health Conference. It's the annual conference, and I caught up with Jules Kim, CEO of Scarlet Alliance, and I asked her what it was that she was doing and getting out of the conference.
There's been a lot of great sessions about HIV criminalisation, which I've found exciting.
When AIDS 2014 came to Melbourne, it was the first time that sex workers were included in that conversation. Are you seeing that marked a change in the sector's understanding of your needs, and then is that extrapolating out, you know, 2 years down the track? Is that extrapolating out into the broader community?
I hope so. Sex workers have been talking about this for a long time. We had really great evidence from The Lancet that was launched at AIDS 2014, and then having that scientific evidence for the value of decriminalisation, and actually that modelling that found that it would reduce 33 to 46% of new infections over the next 10 years was amazing, you know, and that was great because we know within our sex worker communities that is the best model for sex worker rights, health and safety. But now we're sort of kind of getting the scientific evidence, we're getting kind of a few the bigger players putting their weight behind it. Now we've had Amnesty International step in and recognise the human rights benefits as well. And I think that there is a growing recognition, but with that growing recognition has been the growing kind of opposition too. Yeah.
Right. So just explain that. Explain that opposition and how it manifests in such a vocal way.
Well, we've had Scarlet Alliance, along with many other, you know, organisations, have directly had our funding questioned. People have written to our funders and said, why are you funding a bunch of whores, you know, to talk about their rights, you know?
Well, let's see what happens if you don't.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And what was really surprising, the one that they found the most objectionable from Scarlet Alliance was the migration project that hires migrant sex workers to work with migrant sex workers. And that...
They don't come in on 246 visas.
No, right, right. So...
Really?
I know, it's crazy. But, and we've had all these personal slurs, there's been questions and notice, there's a few senators that have picked up on it, a few conservative senators that have picked up on the attacks. So you kind of have to go, when you see these really deeply personal attacks, you know, to these issues for people that are kind of putting themselves out there, you just have to go, well, maybe we're doing the right thing and that they're getting scared, you know. What else can you do?
We're speaking with Jules Kim, who heads Scarlet Alliance, and it is the organisation that advocates for the rights of sex workers right around the country. Jules, the organisation itself has been through an interesting change over recent years. Where is it at and how are things going?
Things are going good, you know, like all the national peaks, you know, the funding environment hasn't been kind.
But that has got nothing to do with the internal battles and internal culture. Yeah, how's the organisation going?
Yeah, organisation's going great. You know, as you know, long-term CEO Janelle Fawkes is recently handed over the reins to myself. And so I've been CEO of Scarlet Alliance since March, but, had been acting up in the role for some time prior. We've gotten a lot of new staff members as well.
A new sense of energy and commitment?
Yeah. Oh, look, we never lose our commitment.
The cause is too important.
Right, absolutely. you know. And I think, I mean, it sort of feels like in some ways that we're getting closer, you know, like, and it is, I mean, even just recently, well, this year I was also elected as the chairperson for APNSW.
Which is?
The Asia Pacific Network of Sex Workers. And, you know, and even just the, seeing around the region, there's been some amazing sort of campaigns that have been happening around the region, while simultaneously the funding environment is becoming more and more hostile. You know, it seems like there is this momentum within sort of, you know, the groundswell of sex worker advocacy, which is exciting.
Sex worker laws in Victoria are diabolical. New South Wales is considered the best place, I guess, to live and work as a sex worker. And South Australia is undergoing a process of change and consultation at present, potentially to go from one of the worst to one of the best. Could you explain that arc for us?
Yep, sure, absolutely. South Australia, if these laws are passed, they will be the best laws in the world.
Wow, that's a big call.
It is, and it's true, because New South Wales, we're decriminalised, but not really for street-based sex workers, you know, and there's some ridiculous caveats around, you know, street-based sex workers, anti-clustering, zoning. New Zealand, there's those clauses against migrant sex workers, and there's probity checks as well, which means that we don't really have full decriminalisation anywhere. South Australia, Scarlet Alliance and SIN, the Sex Industry Network in South Australia, have worked a long time advocating with some key politicians, you know, and that's what it takes, and people with political will to actually progress this. It has been really fortunate to get this really awesome bill before Parliament, which is full decriminalisation, 100% full decriminalisation, with spent conviction clauses as well. So if you have a charge for sex work and only sex work previously, before the laws come into place, then those charges will be expunged. Which is
brilliant. That's a big call.
That's brilliant, yeah. And because we found, even when decriminalisation came into play in New South Wales and New Zealand, there were people that were still experiencing significant barriers because of the convictions that they got before those changes came into play. Also, there's a whole suite of anti-discrimination provisions in this bill as well, which is amazing. And currently we don't have consistent anti-discrimination provisions in Australia.
That would come under the Discrimination Act?
Yeah, so it's as packaged into this bill are the changes to the, you know, Discrimination Act, as well as, you know, the Criminal Code. Yeah.
So what picks up the slack? Is it occupational health and safety? Is it regulation, or in terms of ensuring that the industry operates as a sector that any other business would?
So it depends on what you're talking about. So there's a whole range of different players, and I think people often think it means no regulation, but it just means that we come into the mainstream regulation, right?
So any business that operates needs to get a business license,
exactly,
from any government.
Same. Yep, exactly. Same. Licenses, and we have, you know, Fair Work if there's labour violations, and then there's WorkSafe for occupational health and safety, you know, and then there's sex worker organisations and sexual health clinics, etc., providing services to sex workers.
And presumably there'll be produced guidelines to operate brothels, and they have to, you know, adhere to those guidelines and things.
Right, yep. And we're currently working on the revision, we're feeding into the revision of the New South Wales guidelines. That will certainly be taking place. We recently took the South Australian parliamentarians on a brothel tour around New
South Wales. How did that go?
It was interesting. I mean, I don't know how honest I should be, really.
No, please. No one's listening.
I'm sure. There was one politician that seemed to be very interested in the shoes. Took many photos of the shoes.
That'll do. Love it. Well, this is an exciting time. You know, I can't understand why people in Parliament, every time a legislation is coming under review or they want to change a law, that they don't opt for the best possible outcome globally. Like, it frustrates me that they compromise to such an extent that they get this basket case of something that is then adjusted and ends up being worse than what it was before.
So true. This is so true. And this is the problem as well. Like, you know, even when we have decriminalisation in New South Wales, it's constantly being chipped away at. Every 2 years, there's another review. And again, it was introduced by Paul Green, the Christian Democrat, in Parliament in New South Wales. You know, every time you get a Conservative politician that wants to make a name for himself or wants to kind of, you know, it knows that sex workers are an easy target, you know, and unfortunately it means another review, and it means that we have to, again, write submissions and campaign to keep decriminalisation, even though all the evidence says this is the best model.
You have a huge advocate and former sex worker in Parliament in Victoria. How is that going to help change our laws, do you think, and are you working towards reviewing what our state currently enacts.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Look, you know, and we've got a lot of, there's a lot of great advocates as well on the ground. Like, you know, we have Vixen, Jane Green from Vixen, doing a lot of work there as well. It's Victoria, I think, you know, people think legalisation, licensing, you know, often think that that's a preferable model. But in a lot of ways, it's far more restrictive and damaging than even criminalisation.
And takes a lot more commitment from government to police and regulate and oversee.
It costs them a lot of money. Like, I mean, you look at the Queensland example, it continues to cost the government millions of dollars. They thought after a couple of years, we'll start making money off it. You know, that's the idea that they have, that licensing is going to start to bring in money, you know? Yeah, right. Yeah.
All it does is actually break corruption within the ranks of those inspectors.
Exactly right, you know? And that's why they went for decriminalisation in New South Wales, because they said, we don't want that, you know? Because it was because of police corruption we brought in decriminalisation, you know? So why would we put them in charge of the sex industry, right?
And it's you guys that are apparently the bad ones. Look, Jules, thank you so much for joining us. And look, enjoy the rest of Ashoom.
Lovely. Thanks very much.
Jules Kim there, the CEO of Scarlet Alliance, the organisation that advocates for sex worker rights. Last week, Jim Obergefell was in Melbourne in a private audience with people who are working towards marriage equality here in this state. Anna Brown had a conversation with him. The Informer was lucky enough to be there, and this is what occurred. Anna Brown began by asking Jim what it was that brought this case to the Supreme Court.
I was lucky, and the third time I met this man named John, I fell in love. And pretty much right from that moment on, I knew he was the person I wanted to spend my life with. And we lived in Ohio, a state that did not allow marriage for same-sex couples. And we just built a life together, and we worked together. Everyone knew us. We were open no matter where we went. Working together, we were always an openly gay couple. And in 2011, I noticed when John was walking, his gait sounded different. His walk sounded different. His left foot was slapping the floor harder than his right foot. So we started a series of doctor visits and tests, and it turned out that he had motor neuron disease, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And with that disease, typically most people die in 2 to 5 years. So that was in 2011. And in 2013, there was a big Supreme Court case in the United States, the Windsor case. And when that decision came out, the Supreme Court struck down part of the Defense of Marriage Act in the states, which meant that the federal government had to acknowledge lawful same-sex marriages from states where they had been performed. And at that point, I spontaneously proposed to John. Now, he was bedridden in at-home hospice care, and I was his full-time caregiver, so he couldn't do anything. I mean, he could move his right hand a little bit, he could turn his head, he could say a few sentences at a time. But we figured out how to get married, and it involved chartering a medical jet. We flew to Maryland, where we got married in the jet, parked on the tarmac. And that was all we wanted to do, simply get married and live out John's remaining days as husband and husband. We got married on a Thursday, and on Saturday of that week, a story about us came out online by our local newspaper. And friends were at a party, and they ran into a friend of theirs who's a civil rights attorney in Cincinnati. And our story came up in conversation. And Al Gerhardstein, the attorney, asked our friends if they thought we might be willing to meet with them. So our friends got in touch, asked us, John and I discussed it, and we said, sure, he can come over. Al came to our home, and he did one thing that both broke our hearts and made us angry. He pulled out a blank Ohio death certificate. And he said, now, guys, I'm sure you haven't thought about this, because why would you be thinking about a death certificate when you've just got married? But do you understand that when John dies, his last official record as a person will be wrong? Ohio will say he's unmarried, and Jim, your name won't be there as his surviving spouse. He's right, we hadn't thought about it. We knew Ohio wouldn't recognize our marriage, but that was abstract. This was something real, something harmful, something hurtful. So we decided to file suit. So on Friday, 8 days after we got married, we filed suit in federal court. And on Monday, 11 days after we got married, I was in federal court for the first hearing. And at 5 o'clock that day, the judge ruled in our favor and said, Ohio, you have to fill out John's death certificate correctly. Our legal argument was that in Ohio, Ohio would not issue marriage licenses to cousins, first cousins, or to underage people. But if there were two first cousins who got married legally in another state and they moved to Ohio, Ohio would immediately recognize that marriage. Same thing with underage. So our argument was, if you recognize marriages performed in other states that you would not allow to be performed in Ohio, then you should also recognize our marriage. So that was our argument, and we won. And, well, John died 3 months later, but he died knowing his death certificate was accurate. And then our case was consolidated with five others from four states, and we went to appeals court. They ruled against us, which then set up our appeal to the Supreme Court. And June 26th of 2015, the Supreme Court ruled in our favor.
How did that feel?
It was pretty amazing. To be in that courtroom and to hear the highest court in the land say, John and Jim, you do matter. Couples like you, I was only one of more than 30 plaintiffs. Other couples, parents, children, the youngest plaintiff was 2 years old, a boy named Cooper. And to hear the court say, yeah, your marriages do matter. You deserve respect and dignity. It was a wonderful feeling. And, you know, other than missing John in that moment and wishing he were there to experience it, I realized for the first time in my life as an out gay man, I felt like an equal American. And that day, across the country, it was such a celebration and just a wonderful experience to hear those words and to feel better, feel equal for the first time in my life.
It's a tribute to you, how you've managed to turn what's an immense experience of grief and loss into something that's incredibly positive. So how long exactly did it take from start to finish? Because I think some people do underestimate how long these litigation battles can take.
Well, our case actually, as far as a case that makes it all the way to the Supreme Court, it was fairly quick. Well, we've got our first win, our first ruling on July 22nd, 2013. June 26, 2015 is when the Supreme Court ruled. So it was a little less than 2 years, which for a case to go all the way through our court system in less than 2 years was actually really pretty quick.
Wow. That is remarkably quick in a way. And most people might have heard, but you did get a phone call from the president, didn't you?
I did, yes. After the decision was read, had to sit in the courtroom while we listened to the dissent, and then two more decisions were read. And then we finally got to leave the courthouse or the courtroom, and we go out in front of the courthouse out onto the plaza filled with thousands and thousands of cheering people and walking through the crowd as the crowd split before us. And I and some of the other plaintiffs and attorneys, we spoke to the press. So there were all the microphones set up. We spoke to the press. And then I did an interview with CNN, and I finished the interview. I turned around and someone hands me a phone, and it's on speakerphone. And here I am in the midst of these thousands of cheering, celebrating people trying to hear the speakerphone, and it's the president. And I'd been told that my number had been given out in case anyone wanted to call, but it was kind of this general statement. So here's the president calling to talk to me, and I had no idea what he said. Every interview question after that, the first thing they asked me was, well, what did the president say? What did you say? I don't know. I couldn't remember a single thing. I didn't even know if I formed complete sentences. And the funny thing is, as I was talking with the president, the vice president called and went to voicemail. So he did a call back, so I got to talk with him as well. But the really good thing was I was happy that it happened the way that it did, because the CNN camera crew caught the call on camera. So I was able to watch it about a day later and breathe a sigh of relief that I did form complete sentences and I was respectful. Because I really had no idea. But, to have the president call and tell you and say, thank you, Jim, you and your husband helped make our country a better place. That's an amazing experience to have.
Incredible. And did you ever imagine you'd be involved in this sort of case?
No, not at all. John and I weren't activists. Our way of being activists was signing checks for organizations or causes we believed in. That was it. There was one time in my life when I did something that I would call being an activist. And in the early 90s, the city of Cincinnati, the city council passed a human rights ordinance, and it included protections for the LGBTI community. And there was a backlash. And that backlash prompted a ballot issue that my fellow Cincinnatians, my neighbors, passed. And that ballot issue amended the city charter to say that no laws could be passed to protect the LGBTI community. So Cincinnati became known as the most gay, unfriendly city in the world, in the country. And when that was up for a vote, that's the only time I ever did something that was even remotely called activism. I protested outside of a polling place against that ballot issue. That was it. This came out of the blue. And it really was just the series of things that we could have never planned on, never expected. John being diagnosed with motor neuron disease, the Windsor decision coming out, my spontaneous decision to propose, our friends running into their friend, the civil rights attorney. It was all of these things that just happened. So that's why I called myself an accidental activist, because I couldn't have planned that. Could have never expected any of that to happen.
by the end of the journey, there was a lot of non-accidental activists involved. Do you have any reflections on how sort of you taking this case and the legal strategy that your lawyer was developing for you, how that how you navigated that within a broader movement towards marriage equality that had a lot of players and presumably other legal organisations and NGOs, and even the litigation itself sounds so complex, like there would have been many chiefs or cooks and people making decisions.
Absolutely. So, you know, I was one of more than 30 plaintiffs, and there were more than 20 total attorneys once all the six cases came together. And I will tell you, right after we filed our case in Ohio, our attorney, Al, he got a lot of pushback from national organizations, legal organizations, gay rights organizations, saying, this is not the right case. We have the strategy in place for marriage equality. This falls outside of it. This is not the right thing to be doing. And they tried to talk him out of it. Al, our attorney, he's an amazing man, and this is one of the things I love about him most. He always kept us foremost in his mind. And his response was, no, this is absolutely the right case because I have clients who are being harmed. This is the right thing to do. It doesn't matter what your strategy might have been or what your strategy is. I have clients who have to be helped. That was always his focus. It was always on his clients. And he talked them all into believing that it was the right strategy. So, you know, we were one of six cases that was, you know, two questions. And when we went to the Supreme Court, it was really two main questions. Does the Constitution require marriage equality, you know, the ability to marry? And does the Constitution require that states must recognize those lawful marriages? So all of these various arguments, you know, death certificates. Our attorney also had a case about birth certificates. He had three lesbian couples in the greater Cincinnati area with children, a gay couple in New York who adopted it in Ohio. So it was all about birth certificates. You know, these kids deserved accurate birth certificates that showed both parents' names. So all these different arguments, all these different legal things, and the four states involved all went after them in different ways. I have to say, the state of Ohio, I give them some credit. They never went down the path of all of those horrible lies about LGBTI people. There was never anything that, you know, they're depraved, they make horrible parents, they can't be parents. It was never any of that argument. The other states did, but Ohio didn't. Ohio always came down to, well, the people of Ohio voted on this constitutional amendment, so it's the will of the people. And one of my favorite memories of Al, our attorney, and it was the very first hearing, that argument came up. You know, the people voted on this, so what right do your clients have to say the will of the people should be disregarded? And Al's immediate response was, the surest way to abridge the rights of a minority is to allow the majority to vote on it. And that was our argument throughout the entire course. It doesn't matter that the majority of people voted on it. That doesn't make it constitutional. Mm. So that was a big part of our argument at every step of the way.
And how did it feel for you knowing that the majority of people from the state where you grew up and were raised were actually against this, against you having these rights? And do you think that changed over time?
It hurt, but I also, and even with the most recent election in the states, I have to remind myself about that election, but also this constitutional amendment in Ohio. We have terrible voter turnout in the states. So even though the majority voted for it, it was the majority of the voters, which was still a minority of citizens. So it was hurtful. And I do have to say, you know, in 2004, when that constitutional amendment was passed banning same-sex marriage in Ohio, that was a good year, bad year for those of us who lived in Cincinnati, because that same year, the people of Cincinnati repealed that charter amendment, that horrible amendment that said no laws could be passed to protect our community. That was repealed the same year Ohio passed the marriage amendment. So good year, bad year, but it was painful. And, you know, the whole campaign around the marriage amendment was just deplorable. It really was. It relied on all of those disproven arguments that were horrible, and that it was a terrible experience. But attitudes were changing, absolutely changing across the country. Before the Supreme Court ruled in our case, polls showed clearly 65% of Americans were in favor of marriage equality. The states kept saying, well, the people are voted for this. Well, let's look at current day polls.
Yeah.
That was 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. People thought once we got marriage, I heard this over and over, oh, well, you're done. The gay rights movement is done. You can get married. You have everything you want and you need, right? Not even close.
Exactly. So, I mean, you would know that we've done things in a slightly different order here.
Yes.
Marriage is almost like this last little right. And it will really be a symbolic victory in many ways, but it's that idea that this legal status and what it means in terms of social recognition,
right,
and for people being able to say to one another and their family and their friends that they are recognised by the state,
yep,
as being in a committed relationship. That's what's, I think, so important in Australia in the marriage equality debate at the,
yeah,
moment.
Well, I know for me, being able to say husband and have it mean something, that's a word that everyone knows what that means.
Mm.
And to be able to say that and be proud about that, know that it carried everything that goes with that term. John and I felt completely different when we got married. I mean, in some ways, nothing changed, but in other ways, everything changed. I mean, we just felt different. We felt better. A civil union isn't the same as marriage, no matter what anyone says. Just is not the same.
Yeah. And in the US, it actually has substantial sort of legal effect as well.
It does.
So it meant that you were deprived of legal rights and entitlements even after your partner's, your husband's passing, that there was that risk of you losing that recognition, but that also substantive legal rights as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, I'll share something for us that was very personal with this, which we didn't even realize until we were into the legal case. When John's mom passed away, he went to the cemetery where his grandparents had bought a plot, and he wanted to pick the plot for his mom and also set aside the one next to her for her boyfriend of 18 years at the time. And he discovered that when his grandparents bought this plot, they added something to the deed that said only direct descendants and their legally married spouses could be buried or memorialized on that plot. So John could not put his mom's boyfriend there at the time he died. And that also meant that I couldn't be next to John, whether I was buried or just memorialized. We couldn't be there together on his family plot. So that was something for us, a very real thing that was impacting us because of the death certificate. And there were just so many things that it impacted. And, in the States, I think there are over 1,800 benefits that come with marriage.
Yeah.
That's a lot to give up.
Thank you very much to Anna Brown for that, with Jim Obergefell, the man whose Supreme Court case got marriage equality across the line in the USA. And the Informer would also like to thank Affirm Press for that opportunity. And you can see that interview in full by going to our podcast at joy.org.au/The Informer. That's it from me. I'm Dean Beck. You can follow me at Dean Beck on air, and you can follow The Informer at The Informer Joy. Till next time, keep well. Take care.
Saturday Magazine with Macca. On the line from Boston, Chris Weinberg. How are you, Chris?
Okay, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Joining us now on The Informer is Senator Janet Rice.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Easy, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, melt, upgrade it.
We've had a main beam plus undervolt.
Technologic.
Roger, main beam undervolt.
Technologic.
Okay, stand by at 13, we're looking.
The Joy 94.9 Tech Drive is on now. Help us raise the funds needed for vital upgrades to our broadcasting equipment, ensuring that your community radio station continues to deliver a quality sound, the most comprehensive on-air LGBTIQ news service across the country, and the most informative and entertaining content from your favourite joysters. All donations over $2 or more are tax deductible, so donate now. Head to joy.org.au and click on the Donate Now button. And remember, Joy is on-air, we don't run on-air.
Technologic.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.